Hello and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is Craig Cooper. He's a venture capitalist, entrepreneur, author of Your New Prime, and is also a big advocate for health and wellness and men over the age of 40. As a kid, he was briefly in a coma. He nearly had his leg amputated and had a pretty serious health condition, all by the age of 18. He was actually one of the people who brought Boost Mobile to the United States and was an early investor in companies like Huffington Post and BuzzFeed. Aside from that, he also knows a lot about specific health topics that he's passionate about. We talked about prostate cancer. He's on the advisory board of the Cognitive Health Institute. We talked about Alzheimer's, heart health, the importance of sleep, things like that. So I hope you enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
Did you come on the 57? How do you get here? I don't know.
I live in Orange County. It's like two freeways, the 73 and the 405. That's it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes.
So I came on the 405, and thankfully, there was no accidents.
Do you have to come up to LA a lot?
Up until a couple of years ago, I was coming up consistently 2 to 3 times a week because I was doing a lot of work with Lionsgate, the entertainment company, around a number of their media platforms. So I was up here more for that. But, you know, it is so crazy now that, you know, really you have to, you know, you have to kind of leave at 10:30 and be on the road back by 2, or else it takes, you know, 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
But, yeah, thankfully nothing this morning, Kelly.
Good.
Sorry, had a good run.
Good.
On a beautiful California day.
I work with a couple people, one woman in particular who lives in Costa Mesa and commutes here, but she gets here at 5 a.m. and leaves at, I think, 1. Any later than that, I feel like it would be such a headache.
No, it's not happening.
Every day.
Yeah. Like, yeah. What? And I've got a Tesla, so I can go on the free lane, but now it seems everybody's got a Tesla.
Right, yeah.
Especially in Orange County, it's like that Larry David movie where everyone suddenly had the Howard, you know, the electric car. That,
no.
Have you seen that movie?
No.
It's on Netflix.
It is?
Yeah.
What's it called? I'll have to check it out. I mean, I love Larry David. I've seen every episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
He's the guy that was in an electric car startup that had a fight with his boss and went in and said, I've had enough. I want to quit. And you can have all my stock back. You know, moving on to a new life, you know, fast forward 1 year later, the company's worth like $30 billion. Everyone is literally driving the Howard. You know, they show you the streets, it's covered. And this is like Orange County is like this. You know, every corner is like got 5 Teslas on it. And the whole, you know, movie is about, you know, his revenge against his co-founder for, and, you know, it's getting over his reputation of the guy who sort of lost $15 billion by walking out on his options.
Nightmare.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
There's a few stories about that.
So you've lived in Newport Beach, you said, for 20 years.
Yep.
And what year did you move here to the United States permanently?
I came here literally the week of 9/11. And I was sequestered in a hotel room in Reston, Virginia during that week. And that morning when the planes flew into the towers, signing a deal with Nextel, to sell 50% of my cell phone company to them. So I had a company called Boost Mobile.
Yes.
And myself and my partner came over here and we started that up. And when we came, we sold, you know, a little under 50% to Nextel at the time. Don't know whether you remember those guys or not, but it was one of the 5 networks back in 2001. And, you know, I was literally on the treadmill that morning after we'd signed our deal with Nextel, you know, watching the planes.
Probably feeling great.
Yeah, I mean, right? What a crazy time, right? Yeah. We were stuck there for 2 weeks because we couldn't fly out. And we launched that company. We went through a whole process. We built that up to what was the largest prepaid company in the U.S., you know, a significant business.
Did Boost Mobile begin in Australia?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Also launched in New Zealand, and then we brought it to Australia. Sorry, brought it to the USA in 2001. And at the time, it was incredibly disruptive business because there was no prepaid mobile phones in the U.S. at that time. And there was also no one doing consumer branding around mobile phones. So, you know, we remember, you know, laughing about, you know, Verizon's sort of youth marketing strategy, because, you know, the whole strategy revolved around literally putting a, you know, an African-American on the side of a mobile phone box with a skateboard, right? That was kind of the genius of Verizon.
Look, kids, come here.
You know, we're hip, we're cool. So we bought, you know, we basically, you know, we didn't really know that much about mobile phones from a technology perspective, but we were great youth marketers. So we built effectively a youth marketing business around mobile phones. So, you know, we became the largest event holder for, you know, the four key action sports: motocross, skateboarding, surfing, snowboarding. Boost Mobile Pro of surf, skate, snow, and moto. You know, we brought the WCT, the World Cup Surfing, back to the US because at the time, it didn't exist in America. There was no World Cup surfing event being run on United States soil at that time, because the WCT at the time, or the Association of Surfing Professionals, was effectively bankrupt. So we bought that back in. And we also, you know, because I was a surfer, I loved, you know, loved the opportunity. And then my partner was a big motocross rider, so we bought the Yamaha of Troy motocross team as well. And then we just built a lifestyle around our mobile phones. You know, we were big with, you know, pimps and gangsters, because, you know, we had the Nextel packet network, which basically was untappable by the FBI. You probably, you know, wouldn't remember this, but there was our phones were basically push to talk. It was like, they were like walkie talkies. So you couldn't actually, the FBI or any of the three letter agencies had no way to tap into that, that packet that was being transferred between callers. You know, they couldn't put a wedge in between and sort of listen. So all the, you know, you see The Wire and all these, like, you know, gangster movies and, you know, in the US, they're all using Boost Mobile phones back in those days.
Did you know that at the time? I mean, did you learn that after the fact?
We learned it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Because we leveraged our brand off that. And if you'd seen any of our ads at the time, I mean, they were, you know, they were groundbreaking and very controversial. You know, we'd go to Vegas for the Boost Mobile Pro of skateboarding, and you know, we'd walk off the plane and literally there'd be a madam standing at the other end with a basket full of Boost Mobile phones, handing them out to all the girls getting off the plane for the weekend. I was kind of like, okay, that's
here
our market.
Here you go, ladies.
Dollar a day. That was our pitch. Yeah.
Wow.
That was us.
Wow. So, and it was all, Boost Mobile was all prepaid phones.
Yeah.
What were the other competitors at that time that were also doing that? I mean, once you guys started,
Virgin,
who else
was really
came
our
up?
Only competitor.
Oh,
so
okay.
Virgin Mobile, we came off the back of Virgin Mobile. Sorry, let me say that again. We came off the back of Virgin Mobile's, let me say that one more time. Virgin Mobile at the time, for Virgin Mobile for the previous 2 years had been in negotiations with Nextel. It was a lot of money. It was a different business opportunity. That deal didn't go ahead. So we came in off the back of that, and we subsequently did a deal with Nextel. We then competed with Virgin pretty much throughout the period that we owned the company, until both Virgin and Boost were absorbed into Sprint. They ultimately were both purchased by Sprint as their prepaid platforms. But we didn't compete with any of the networks per se, because, you know, we were a very brand-driven company. Whereas everyone else was really competing on the back of, you know, minutes, airtime, data, and everything else around that. And we were 100% competing on brand, you know, by having a Boost Mobile phone. That was kind of our stick.
I think by the time I got a cell phone, I was part of the Sprint. When Sprint absorbed Boost.
Okay.
Yeah, probably like 2003 or four.
Yeah, 2005.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, maybe later then. Yeah. When you first got started with Boost Mobile in New Zealand or Australia, did you already have a cell phone? I mean, like, what was, when you were talking to people about your plans, were people saying like, well, yeah, it makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge, outside of the US at the time, I mean, most of the world was pretty much on prepaid. So the US was the only real country that lagged behind in prepaid penetration. I mean, France, for example, at the time was 70% prepaid. Australia was about 50-50. Mm. The US at the time was about 10 or 15% prepaid. There was no real model for it here. One of the reasons being that a significant part of what is seen to be our demographic, which could be argued to be the unbankable community, Hispanics, low-income workers and the like, just found it difficult to get credit. It sort of drives sort of a different business model around cellular communications. So we sort of slotted into that and we're kind of the first to do it.
Are there a lot of prepaid carriers existing today?
Pretty much everyone's prepaid. Everyone's got a prepaid offering. Sort of more so globally. I spent a lot of time back in Australia recently, just through a bunch of things that I'm doing there. Probably half the population in Australia is on prepaid. It just seems to work for a lot of people.
Actually, I take that back. I spent some time in Guatemala and they all had prepaid there.
For sure, yeah. Europe, across every European country, it's predominantly prepaid.
Prepaid.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, you don't see many iPhones in Europe. You see them, of course, but a lot of Europeans still use flip phones and, cheap, non-smartphones.
Vintage. Yeah. I like that.
Love that, right?
Yeah.
I know. I go into the AT&T store and I see that little, $29 flip phone and I just go.
Charge it and it lasts for a week.
Because that'll drive so much of what I'm trying to achieve in life in terms of deleveraging myself from all my data and all my communications and focusing it around, the key things that matter.
Yeah.
Which are distracted by smartphone communications and Instagram and everything that has us looking down and not up, which focuses us on digital communication rather than real communication.
Right.
Digital relationships rather than real relationships. It's a sort of key driver of my sort of wellness message about trying to get people away from looking down, right? Looking up into the real world. Because so many of the sort of health implications that we're seeing, metabolically and as we age are driven by, factors which are sort of, undermined by how we're communicating today. You look at, loneliness and social isolation, which is a huge problem, globally. Look in the UK, the last month, first time ever, there's been actually a Minister of Loneliness appointed by the government to take account of, the nearly 5 million people that, have, only one form of communication, which is their television. It's a key driver of mental illness. It's a social, issue as well as, as a mental health issue. So I'm trying to get, men in particular who are traditionally more isolationist to give them tools to help them sort of get out of that, get them out of that disorder because it's, it's a big public and social health issue.
Do you think that you could get rid of your smartphone? I mean, just and live
I got rid of it for a period of 8 days. In the last 8 days, you may be looking at me, Kelly, and wondering why has Craig got such an awesome tan?
Yeah. Wait, did you just go swim with whales?
Yeah. How did you know that?
I saw your Instagram.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed by my tan.
No.
That's like,
incredible.
Tan, Mom.
Where'd you go? The Caribbean or something?
We went 100 miles off the north coast of the Dominican Republic.
Nice.
And we sat in the middle of the Silver Bank for 7 days with literally, not a boat or another person or, anyone in sight except for just the most significant global population of humpback whales where they come to give birth and mate. So we sat there for, 6 days and followed them in the, in our small tender boats. We had a, 130-foot boat that we're on, but we followed them every day. And then, we would wait for them to settle. It can be a 7-hour process. We were following some pods for, up to 5 or 6 hours because they're very rowdy when they're down there. They're mating and being courted and hunted by their males, the females are. And so, we would chase them at very low speed, very non-confrontationally for 6 to 7 hours until they decided to settle and have a rest. And then would be, swimming and diving and free diving with them and
That's
engaging
so cool.
with the babies and stuff. Yeah, it was amazing.
Had you seen a whale before in person?
Yeah, lots of times.
Oh.
Yeah. But this was intense. This was just like crazy. There's 5,000 to 7,000 whales in that 26 square miles of the Silver Bank.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, but I mean, they, you know, they're not all there, you know, one time. But so you asked me if I could ever go without my phone. So I had no cell phone for just on 8 days, which was awesome. I had my two daughters with me. It was fantastic for them as well, and my wife. I will admit that I took a satellite phone, and I made two calls, but I had no data. I just needed it for emergency purposes, for business and stuff. But I had no data, you know, none of the normal crap that, you know, keeps us, you know, occupied all day. But here's the beautiful thing about that. I got back on a Friday, and I was flying through home to Miami, and, you know, my family's just like straight on, you know, catching up.
What I missed.
Who's posting what? You know, I refused to do that till I got home. So in 8 days, I got back. It took me only, and I had a lot of emails, but it literally only took me an hour and a half to go through all of those. And I think that hour and a half, that single hour and a half that it took to filter, respond, prioritize, delegate those emails. If I'd been back here, I can imagine, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours over 8 days, right? Because like everyone, I'm constantly reactive.
Right.
I'm sitting there waiting for it to come in. And it just reinforced to me prioritization and urgency and compartmentalizing my emails and my tasks and everything in terms of response time. But also, you know, critically that, you know, we just don't have to live in our inbox, right? And especially from a social perspective, I mean, it just, you know, it's just incredibly addictive. And I didn't miss anything, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not the biggest influencer. I have like no followers. I have a few, but they're all my friends.
Yeah.
I didn't miss anything.
There's so many times where I'm very guilty of it, just sitting there and even sitting with a group of people, whether it's your family or like, a group of friends. And you're sat there and then you notice that every single person is on their phone. And there's so many times I have the realization that, wow, if we weren't holding these phones, I wonder what we'd be talking about right now.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But instead you're just, you know, it's like stifling conversation almost.
Of course it is, yeah.
You know, or just paying attention to what's going on around you. So I want to go back. You lived in New Zealand for a while, correct?
Yeah, I've got a New Zealand passport and a US passport. And I left New Zealand when I was about 14. I was in the New Zealand surf team, so I went to Australia, lived in a tent for literally a year, $27 a week, you know, unemployment benefits from the Australian government, just surfing every day.
So yeah. You moved with your family to Australia?
No, I was just on my own.
Oh, you moved at 14?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. In New Zealand, I feel like I haven't been to New Zealand, but I feel like that would be a haven for just adventure sports,
for sure,
surfing, mountain biking. Did you do all of that when you were a kid?
New Zealand has anything goes there, right? I mean, there's no, you know, platform of litigation or, you know, legal process like we have here, where if you do, you know, crazy shit, you're going to get sued. It's all on in New Zealand, right? You know, they invented bungee jumping and that wasn't good enough from bridges, so they do it from helicopters. You know, everything crazy starts in New Zealand. Australia, sort of less so, but still, you know, awesome. But, you know, New Zealand, when I was growing up, there was a, you know, I was in a, you know, pretty big surf culture. But there was also a really significant gang culture. You know, the Maoris, the Samoans, the Tahitians. So we had Black Power, Headhunters, the Mongrel Mob. And there was like constant gang warfare amongst the Maori and the Samoan gangs. And all the surfers used to be caught up on it. So there was a lot of violence. And so I kind of ran away from that. My parents divorced when I was 9. So I had I was a professional skateboarder. So I lived pretty much on the street. And, you know, at the time, guys my age, and I was 14. I literally left the country, and went to live in Australia. That was happening a lot. Yeah. Just wasn't me.
Yeah.
I look back now and I see a 14-year-old now. I just go,
it's a baby.
One, probably they're just not capable because they just don't have the, you know, they're so, I live in Orange County, I must say, you know, it's an entitlement community. Everyone down there is coddled. But pretty much every 14-year-old I see down there, I say, you get dropped even in New York, you won't survive, right?
Yeah. So you get to Australia. Where do you go first? I mean, did you know? Do you at least know a friend of a friend who was there? And you know,
I went with another guy, and we he was 15, so he had his driver's license. So we flew to Sydney first. We bought a $500 car, and we drove that up the whole east coast to the Gold Coast, which is kind of the mecca for surfing in Australia. And we just lived the life.
Were you in school?
No, I left school when I was 13.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
I went back when I was 21 in Sydney. I eventually moved to Sydney, 5 years later. I went back to TAFE College, which is kind of like, what's the college you go to here as an adult or as a...
Like a community college?
Right? Yeah. I went to that. I ended up getting in the top 1% of the state of New South Wales and going back and studying economics and law. And I ended up getting honours in both of those. So that sort of migrated me into a legal career for about 7 or 8 years. And then after that, I started an energy company called Energy Asia Pacific. And we were the largest mobile phones. We're the largest private electricity producer in Australia. We had about 3,000 megawatts of assets. It was about $5 billion worth of assets. And then through that sort of segued into, a bunch of tech investments and businesses and partnerships, which sort of led me into the mobile phone business that brought me to the United States.
Okay, so hold on. We need to
I
can see why it's confusing because you've done 1 million things, as I was saying before we even started recording. I need to unpack a few things, though, like a few decades back. So when you're, first of all, you were in a coma, correct? When you were a little kid.
9, yeah.
9 years old. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen?
When you look back, what's driven me to where I am today, I mean, it's pretty life-changing events, literally, and life-threatening events. I was in a coma when I was 9. I had encephalitis in my brain, which is an inflammation of the brain. I had osteomyelitis when I was 11 in my left leg. So I nearly lost my left leg. That was again another virus.
So when you were 9, did you have symptoms and then all of a sudden you passed out? Or what led up to that?
I was really young, right?
Yeah.
I had symptoms, but I can't really remember. It was a long time
ago. Right, yeah.
But I was put on a private farm with a nurse who was a friend of the family's, like way up in North New Zealand. She looked after me for a month.
So you were in a coma for a month?
Yeah, I was kind of in and out of it.
Wow.
Yeah, but I was coming in and out, but I was like, I'd have a week where I'd be gone. And so that was crazy. Yeah, osteomyelitis when I was 11, pericarditis when I was 18. So I've got a big scar down my chest from a heart surgery I had. I had a viral inflammation in my heart. They got a key to all of these. When they're all itises, pericarditis, osteomyelitis, encephalitis, they're all, and itis is basically inflammation-based. So, when you look at sort of all modern medicine today, and where they're sort of, reaching back to in terms of, the core foundation of disease, inflammation is a huge driver of that. So part of, what I've been doing in terms of getting my message out there, it's been 100% Selfridge for myself in terms of, men's health and trying to be a voice for that. But also, secondly, educating other men, as to how to be well and how to live a life of wellness. Thirdly, ultimately when you look around, you realize that most men are pretty useless about their health, right? They don't take care of themselves until they get sick. They're not interested in anything from a health perspective besides looking fit, whatever that means, right? And of course, health and fitness are complete opposite ends of the spectrum of wellness. My mission is to be a voice for that when there is no voice, because there's a lot of voices for women's health. There's certain voices for men's health in a certain package, and that's really around the sort of media-driven fitness and wellness magazines and everything they put out as being, you know, a healthy lifestyle, which literally doesn't change any, you know, month to month, from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. You know, it's six-pack abs and biceps. That's what, you know, that's the message.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you're 8 or 80. The nutrition advice is also the same. The supplementation advice is the same. The exercise advice is the same. So there's no recognition of, let's call it 40-plus men as a specific demographic and the unique needs of those men, mentally, sexually, physically, emotionally, as they progress through this, you know, let's call it, you know, the midlife crisis, whatever that means, or just midlife, and how to go through that and come out, you know, energized in a environment of opportunity and not one of complacency, which most men fall into as they age.
So when you, when you're 20s and 30s, were you, after some of those health scares, did that prompt you to be, to looking at your health and changing your diet and being more physically active and all of those things?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've always been, if I look back probably, you know, to my, you know, late teens and definitely my early 20s, you know, I just sort of picture myself now what I was doing then. I've always been super active. I haven't been as scientific about it as I am now and have been for the last 20 years. But I've always been outside. I mean, we talk about New Zealand. It's, you know, very much an outside, you know, culture and lifestyle. You know, Australia is the same. It's just a beautiful country. It's just a very healthy environment. People ask me how long I've, you know, looked after myself. It's kind of been my whole life. You know, you can't. And I think nowadays what science is showing us as well in terms of the preconditions to disease as you age, they start in your 20s. Epigenetically, in terms of influencing your genes and your wellness, it starts very early. So it's important to get that message across. You know, I'm very much involved in the prostate cancer. I wouldn't say business,
yeah,
but it is a business. But in terms of, you know, helping men and providing resources for men with cancer and other disorders as men age. And you look at prostate cancer specifically, I mean, men in their 20s are getting it and it's much more aggressive. Traditionally, it's seen as an old man's disease and it's, you know, it's really not. All the preventative messages from the main industry bodies, I believe, are sending the wrong signal around testing and diagnosis for the wrong reasons.
Do they tell you to go later on in life?
Yeah, versus... the message now, as of the last 6 months, is saying effectively from the U.S. Preventative Task Force that you don't need to get your what's called PSA tested, which is a simple blood test, unless you're at risk or have a family history of the disease. And that's just such a massively gray area, which basically leaves it up to the patient now to ask for it, which is not going to happen because it's, prostate checks have always been a laughing matter with men, right?
Yeah.
Until it's not a laughing matter. You know, they make jokes of it all the time, you know, TV and sitcoms and whatever. So it does a disservice. I believe you should be checked in your 30s, like I was. I had my first check at 39. What that does for you, even if you don't have prostate cancer, a high prostate-specific antigen test at least gives you an indication that something is wrong. It's a dashboard. And the problem is in the current medical environment is that the argument against PSA testing is driven by what happens after it, because there's this rush to biopsy. If you have a high reading, let's call it 4 to 5, there's just this rush to biopsy you. And it's a massively invasive and uncomfortable process. And there's a lot of false negatives and false positives around that. So that's where it gets murky. But I think, you know, men should be more proactive and ask for the test.
So I'm curious, so you have some of these health scares, you obviously are going to college, you start investing in certain companies and your business career takes off. So when along the way besides personal reasons, yourself wanting to be healthy, when along the way do you come to say, okay, I think I want to dedicate a lot of my time to helping other people, specifically men 40 and older at this time in their life? I mean, was it when you got to that age and you noticed like people around you weren't focusing as much on those things and you wanted to help? I mean, what?
Yeah, I mean, I had a, apart from all my, you know, big scares when I was young, my my biggest scare came when I was 39, when I actually had that test, right, which showed I had, you know, a high PSA, and it's continued at the same level to this date. So the normal range is sort of 1 to 4, and mine was 5, and, you know, I can go to 200, but 5 is overly suspicious. So I went through a medical system which did exactly what we were talking about. It rushed me into a biopsy and subsequent biopsies, and all driven by what I saw as the urological community's effort to just you know, find cancer. You know, it was like I'd have a biopsy, it would be like, oh, it's negative, but, you know, come back in 6 months, we'll do another one, and like maybe we'll find it then, right? And it'd be like, let's be like a celebration for them, because then they could put me into this whole system of treatment, which is driven by all this, you know, the pharmacological companies and pharmaceutical companies and equipment makers. And there's this whole industry that sits behind treating men with prostate cancer, which starts with that PSA test. And that's what I try to rally against. And in my personal situation, I came out of that. And I was lucky enough at the time, you know, I knew the people at the Milken Institute and a lot of people who are associated with that. So I got introduced to Mike Milken, and he introduced me to the head of the Prostate Cancer Foundation, Dr. Stu Holden, the medical director. So I've been under his umbrella since that time, looking after me. But for me, Kelly, it was just a massive wake-up call, because the more I looked into it, the more, you know, I saw a lifestyle that was just not going to be my future, right? Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about it being a treatable disease, but it's an incredibly destructive disease for a man, from the point of view of your mental health, your sexual health, and everything that flows from it. So I became sort of just incredibly passionate about myself at that time. And, you know, I started a small website at the time called prostate.net, and as a sort of feeder for information and resources around that, which is now the largest digital platform for men's prostate health. So we're kind of like the WebMD for prostate health. Huh? So I started that as a resource to just get information out there, because I knew there was other men like me who just weren't, one, getting the treatment that I was, and who weren't getting the same information that I was. So I decided to start a platform for that, a digital platform for that. And then more and more, as that sort of like flowed through over the years, I just had consistently phone calls every week from friends in my media network and sort of concentric circles. And the phone call would always be the same, most often by people who I hadn't spoken to for a while. Hey, Craig, what's up? You know, be like, can I come see you next week? I said, sure, what's up? Oh, I just want to talk to you about something. I knew exactly what it was about, right? They all arrived, they're always with their wives. It's happened to me probably 25 times over, you know, 8 or 9 years. And they come to my office, and as soon as they walk in, I go, so what's your PSA reading, right? What's going on? I go, you know, take a deep breath. Because once you get a diagnosis of prostate cancer, it's like having a pin drop, right? And like everything, you become a passionate patient.
Right.
You need to be, you have to be. You know, I was on talking about being on the boat with these guys last week, and you know, I ended up having sessions most night with guys of sort of my age around this, right? Because a few of them downloaded my book before they came, because they kind of must have searched me, and so you know, we had a lot of discussions around that, I wanted to be a resource for guys like that. And because, you know, most men, they don't have anyone to talk to. It's not something that you want to openly have a discussion with other men. And I was quite happy to put myself out as that resource.
Yeah, that is, I mean, generally speaking, for all men and all women, doesn't that seem to be, I don't know if you found it to be the case to where women, as they get older, seem for the most part to keep their friends.
For sure, yeah.
But not always men as they get older.
In fact, it's the opposite.
Would you agree with that?
100%. I mean, the men constantly on a year-by-year basis dilute their friendships as they get older. 65% of men over 50 have one friend. It's amazing.
Like just in terms of, you know, confiding in other people, like, hey, are you going through this? Hey, are you going to go, you know, get a checkup for this? You know, just people to bounce things off of.
Of course. It's incredible. I mean, the numbers are just shocking. And even more so when you sort of, when you look at sort of the top tier of executives and, you know, high performers, and there's a huge suicidal rate in Silicon Valley, which is being driven a lot by this because of sort of this whole lone wolf entrepreneurial environment and the pressure to succeed and the inability to talk to anyone about it, lest you be known as, you know, weak, wanting help. It's a massive issue. And, you know, in my book, I talk about actively cultivating tribes, which I, you know, do constantly. I have a call register that I'm just constantly refreshing around people that I telephone, not text, not email, to catch up on. I have a lot of young friends that I sort of aspirationally look down to in a lot of things. And I have my own tribe of my own age. And then I have a lot of people who are a lot older than me that I aspirationally look up to, but I actively cultivate it. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this private equity hedge fund guy, 73-year-old guy in Orange County who I ran into hiking about 3 years ago, and who I'd known, you know, for a couple of years, and started talking about adventures and trips and everything. He was telling me how he was about to go on this trip to Africa to do Kilimanjaro. And I said, "That's awesome. Who are you going with?" And he said, "We got no one to go with." He said, "All our friends have fallen away. You know, they can't keep up with us. And they just don't have the desire to do anything, you know, adventurous anymore." And it's a couple that, you know, keep themselves, you know, in great shape and great nutrition, look after themselves. They're actively out there trying to maintain a really healthy and positive lifestyle. But there's no one that they can take with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive, massive issue, especially for guys sort of at, you know, at my level. So I'm trying to openly get guys to actively seek out help and discussions around everything from, you know, their mental health to their sexual health to, you know, because women quite openly talk about their sexual health with other women. The men just doesn't happen, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, it drives obviously a lot of social and mental health issues, but a lot of physical health issues. You know, most men, pretty much 90% of men with erectile dysfunction have, you know, a high propensity for heart attack and cardiac risk. Because it's all about blood flow and vice versa. If you've got cardiovascular disease, then you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to have, you know, erectile dysfunction and other diseases other comorbidities around blood
and
flow.
And that's not something a group of guys are just you don't openly shit about.
Discuss that with your buddies, right?
Yeah.
You know, the drug industry preys on it because the whole industry was created around the little blue pill. That's now gone because of the generic drugs that are now being released around, particularly Viagra, Sildenafil, being the core drug. But there's a whole new wave of drugs now being pushed on men to take the place of that sort of $15 billion hole that's been opened up around the ED drugs coming off patent, and that's low testosterone, right? And which is being, you know, actively marketed as a disease to men, whereas in fact it's a very much a lifestyle driven disorder, but it's being packaged by the major drug companies as a disease of aging, which it's not. And their treatments for it are incredibly destructive and literally don't work. I mean, people think of, you know, testosterone is something that's just going to pump you up and, you know, make you, you know, sexually strong and, you know, alert and give you energy. But, you know, the studies just don't support it.
Mm-hmm.
It does some things, but placebo does just as much. And on the other side of the fence, you know, you've got a high risk for heart disease and stroke and a whole bunch of other things. So, you know, we've got to be aware and, you know, people don't look at the information. They get their sound bites from, you know, the 6 o'clock news. As I said before, you know, whether you're 8 or 80, you're getting the same message. You know, it's the sad diet, you know, the standard American diet, or it's the fad diet, right?
Which is
the, you know, effing awful diet. And, you know, it's an easy community to put, you know, to drop little bits of disinformation into, because we're men and because we want to be masculine, because we want to be the man, we suck it up so easily, right? And it's like the bulletproof craze, right? Classic example. You know, ketogenic diet has a lot of benefits, but why are you doing it? For what reason? Lose weight, insulin resistance, those are valid, but it all depends on how you want to implement it. You know, you're not going to do yourself a service by eating bacon all day and, you know, processed meats. It's basically what the ketogenic diet is.
Mm-hmm.
It's great if you eat healthy fats and good fats, but unless you educate yourself about it, it's going to do you harm and disservice.
Right. You need to dig a little deeper.
Yeah. It's like, exactly.
Like, yeah. Literally with anything.
Yeah.
I feel like, especially in this day and age.
Right.
So I'm curious if when you're growing up somewhere along the way, I know you said you went back to school when you were a little bit later. Did you have any mentors or just people around you that, because you seem to be very hardworking and a very driven person from what I gather. Have you always been that way? Were there a couple influential people that you looked at who were doing certain things that you're doing now and you're like, wow, yeah, I want to aspire to that?
I've always had mentors. But if I look right back to when I moved to the Gold Coast when I was 15, I was a really good tennis player. And so I got absorbed into a group of lawyers who were in their sort of mid to late 20s who were, you know, had lawyer money at the time, which was a lot, right? And lived on the Gold Coast. And, you know, I was a 14, 15-year-old surfer bum. I got absorbed into their tennis group. And one of them, a guy called Stephen James, who was about 8 or 9, maybe 10 years older than me, so I kind of took me under his wing. And he's the guy that really sort of pushed me into going back to school, going back to Sydney, going to university, spending, you know, 7 years at university. He also told me at the time to learn Chinese. And when I look back sort of 40 years ago now, because I'm 54, it's kind of like prescient at the time, right?
Yeah.
So Steve did that. So that was awesome. I suppose I had probably a 10, 15-year break where I didn't. But since I've recognized more and more the need for it, I've absolutely adopted mentors more and more. You know, I spent a whole bunch of time with Tony Robbins over the years personally, and Tony's been a big driving factor in my life. Over the last 6 months, for the first time ever, I've actually got a performance coach. So I'm under the sort of banner of Dr. Eric Potterat, who's the performance psychologist for the Navy SEALs. And looks after a whole bunch of, you know, professional athletes, Sean White, Lindsey Vonn, and but he's been responsible effectively for the stress response training and psychological training for the global SEALs squads, and there's a lot of them. There's about 3,000 individual SEALs.
Yes.
So I've just adopted Eric's program. So I talk to Eric once a week, and I love it.
Wow, what does that entail?
I think
that sounds intense.
I'll tell you, but I think everyone needs help, yeah, right, at all levels. So everyone has new tools to learn, new skill sets to learn. I wanted Eric to take me to a level of people that I saw on TV and actively operating at peak performance under incredibly stressful situations, and I thought to myself, I want that. And I got introduced to him through the head of Action Sports from IMG, who's on my advisory board for my venture capital fund. And so I sort of, you know, I met with Eric and we went through, you know, his intake process and, you know, series of sort of, you know, long tested questionnaires and meetings that we had. And then we, you know, decided on what we, you know, we wanted to work on. And, you know, because I remember seeing Sean White at the the Olympics this year, right? It's one of Eric's clients. And this is before, I think it was just before I started seeing him for the first time. Seeing Shaun White at the top of that half pipe, that last run, he's the last guy, gold medal run, it's his for the taking. I mean, who doesn't want that, right?
Yeah, it's incredible.
I mean, who can picture themselves being up there executing at your best under that much pressure? Or Kobe, who, you know, during his whole period of his trial and legal cases, scoring, you know, the most points ever in a single game in the NBA, while whole crowds are holding up, you know, banners about him and yelling rapist and everything from the, you know, the stands at the away games. How does that happen? He developed a separate persona called the Black Mamba, right? Yeah. He developed a whole different personality to take care of that. So he was not Kobe Bryant when he went on the court. He was the Black Mamba. And it's funny because they live in our community. And Vanessa drives around. She's got the license plate, Queen Mamba, right?
No, she does.
Yeah, with all diamantes around.
Queen
it.
Mamba.
Yeah, she's the Queen Mamba.
Yeah.
No mistake who's the boss.
Is it true that he helicoptered to practice?
Yeah, but it's a myth that it's his helicopter. It's actually I know the owner of that helicopter super well. He's a longtime great friend of mine. And so Kobe used to charter it from Hal Bryce, if you're listening.
Every practice.
He didn't have his own helicopter. It was the same helicopter. It was the red R-44 with JL tail number. It was not Kobe's. He didn't deny it. Kobe didn't deny it.
I'm not knocking it. There are so many times where I daydream while sat on the 405.
Well, we try to land a lot of times. The owner of that helicopter tried to get a landing permit for the Staples Center, but he could never get one. Oh. So we always had to land at Santa Monica. But Kobe was the only person to get a landing permit for one of the garage structures there, the parking structures.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, it was in
Yeah, well, I guess Santa Monica is a lot closer than down in Newport.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like we were talking about how, I mean, you have a really extensive resume, but just in general, how do you did you meet someone who was in venture capitalism, who was investing in things? I mean, how did you start doing that? I know you majored in economics. Yep. I mean, was that something that you were aware of that you could do and make money off of? And how did you get into that?
I was doing what I thought was sophisticated angel venture capital investing in Australia for about 2 or 3 years, because there really wasn't an active community there. And I was funding a bunch of American deals who would come to Australia for funding, you know, little known to me at the time, because I subsequently, you know, obviously worked out that they were only coming to Australia because they couldn't raise money in the United States and we were the dumb Aussies, right? What did we know? So I lost a whole bunch of money on that, trying to get smarter about the business. I then came to the US, you know, with Boost. And then once I sold Boost, I had a long-term relationship with a guy called Eric Hippo. Eric was on the board of Yahoo and Starwood Hotels and, you know, Ziff Davis. And he was a very significant and longtime friend of mine to this date. And Eric was a partner at SoftBank Capital. And SoftBank was run by, their main investor was Masayoshi Son, the Japanese billionaire. So when I sold Boost, Eric and I got together and they were raising a new fund. And at the time, you know, mobile was growing. You know, the environment around apps for mobile was very nascent. I mean, literally we're investing in ringtone companies, right? That was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
We actually invested in the largest ringtone company at the time.
Smart move. Who didn't like ringtones?
And, you know, I knew a little bit about that because at Boost we did a Roxy phone, right, which was super cool. And we had like 5 ringtones on it that was preloaded by the Roxy Surf Girls.
Nice.
That was kind of like our marketing stick. So Eric and I got together and, you know, Eric was very big on the consumer side online. I was, I had a brand around mobile communications. So I joined that fund. So the four of us raised the first SoftBank Capital fund. was a little under $400 million to invest in broadband businesses that were taking advantage of next generation online and mobile broadband. And you know, that led us into being the first investors in Huffington Post, which were the largest investors.
Yeah.
And
when was that? Like
2004.
Oh, okay. Yeah, five. Which then weren't you one of the early investors in BuzzFeed too?
Yeah, we're still the largest venture firm in BuzzFeed, so our fund is still in there, waiting for that little puppy to go public.
Yeah. Right.
Like every morning I wake up, check, damn.
No, not yet.
Make an announcement.
Yeah.
BuzzFeed, other companies that are not so publicly known, like Xad, a big digital advertising platform, Buddy Media, which was bought by Salesforce. So we had some good wins and a lot of losses, like all venture firms. But there's no real career in venture. You kind of fall into it. Most venture capitalists come into it from either being funded by the firm that you join.
Mm-hmm.
Like you look at a lot of the Sequoia Capital Partners nowadays, they're out of companies like PayPal and the like that they've been successfully invested in, and they've had a good experience with that individual or that founder, and they've brought them into the fund because they want to build a strategic group of people, not just venture capital firms are very loose and fancy, fancy free, it's a complete contrarian environment to Wall Street in terms of dress and attitude and funding structures and the like. So
dress and attitude, you said?
Yeah, it's like jeans and
t-shirts. Oh, it's more casual.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
They're
not doing the, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, I was thinking of Billions.
Yeah, or Billions, yeah. I've started watching that.
They don't
have
performance coaches in venture firms.
No. Oh, okay. No. They should.
Yeah. Venture capital is, private equity and hedge funds is all about financial manipulation, math, and programmatic execution of trading. And some insider trading, right?
Yeah.
Venture is all about relationships and access to deals because there's no shortage of capital, but there is shortage of relationships. So, and because there is so much capital available now, a lot of early stage startup founders have a wide choice of where to get their funding. So most of the good deals and the good exits that result from those good deals, hopefully, are driven by relationships. So venture capital is about relationships.
So you need to have good interpersonal communication. And
you need to be immersed in those communities as well. There's this huge new platform that's being sort of developed around, let's call them finders. In my fund, I call them the honeybees. Venture capital firms, I'm 54, so I can't, I'm not going to go hang out with the 20-year-olds at Burning Man, right? So a lot of these big venture firms now, they're actively recruiting, college students and, millennials to come in and, they don't, they're not on the payroll, but there's a financial structure being put in place that rewards them for delivering them the deals that they hear about. So if they're hanging out with their, buddies at Burning Man and, they hear about a deal and they actively bring that into the firm.
Whoa.
Then there's a structure being put in place for that. I really like it.
Yeah. I know nothing about that. That's why it's very interesting to me. I mean, I really know nothing about it. When you came to the United States with Boost Mobile, it sounds like the prepaid communication situation was hot then.
Yep.
What would you say in 2018 are some fields or industries that you're thinking about right now?
I've started a new venture fund. It's called the Action Fund.
Oh, is that kind of related to green type of, like, giving back to the earth, the planet sort of thing? I was reading about that on your website.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So it's all about anything. I mean, it's really, I'm investing in anything that sort of relates to human progression as well as planetary progression. So from humanity's perspective, clean tech, sorry, green, health tech, med tech, sustainable foods, health and wellness, nutrition, longevity solutions, around from a planetary perspective can be the same: food solutions, environmental sustainability solutions. I've sort of built it around, you know, what's called these sort of 17 key sustainability principles of the United Nations, which have come out in terms of planetary and human survival. So, you know, I feel it's an incredibly important mission, which one that I'm personally passionate about, but it also has a profit objective. So I'm looking for companies in that sector. And I partner with some really interesting, progressive, and, you know, exciting people about it, around it, that I'll be announcing in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I'm certain are going to just, you know, drive significant value for the fund and its investors. I've invested in two companies so far. Invested in an orthopedic brace company that helps patients with diabetes or with plantar fasciitis, tendonitis, which effectively is kind of in the orthopedic space, and foot and ankle orthopedics is a huge sector. I'm invested in a company in Australia called Accor Medical, which makes devices for diagnosing hypertension and pre-hypertension, which is a massive industry. As you know, we talked about previously, you know, I've had significant heart problems myself, so it's a big deal for me. I have a pretty serious heart regime that I sort of undertake from the point of view of my, you know, my nutrition and my exercise is the easy part. I have a $17,000 device, which is actually made by Accor Medical, which tests my arterial stiffness. I take a whole bunch of supplements around it, you know, beet juice, CoQ10, omega-3s. I take this supplement called the Hawaiian astaxanthin, which increases endothelial function and better blood flow, reduces inflammation. So it's an awesome company I discovered the last couple of years that is doing great things. So I have a pretty serious and unusual health program, and within it I have sort of, you know, certain verticals that I'm focusing on. Obviously heart health, sexual health, prostate health. Inflammation's a big driver of what I eat and what I think, because thoughts drive physiological response. My passion is flowing into my business more and more.
Yeah.
Through my books, we mentioned the TV show, which is a lot of fun, with the venture capitalists. I want to be, you know, a voice as well as a disruptor of that industry, in terms of creating businesses that are going to drive massive change and provide a better future for humans and the planet.
Yeah, and it's great because I'm sure at this point in your life you can do that.
Yeah, look, I'm doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's and I'm 100% doing only anything that makes me happy and is fun. That's the key driver, because, you know, I think ultimately, you know, everyone's looking for freedom, right? So I'm lucky I have the freedom to be able to do this and focus on, you know, what I love and what I'm passionate about, and also, you know, have a personal and hopefully a wider benefit flowing from that.
So Adventure Capitalists on CNBC, did you, it's cool because in my opinion, I think it's probably a better setup than Shark Tank because you can try everything. I mean, I don't know how much time the hosts on Shark Tank get to actually use the product. I assume, you know, some amount of time before they invest money, but yeah. You guys are literally in, you know, Moab or wherever, riding a mountain bike or, you know, getting a shark repellent banner, you know, whatever you're doing. What was
you
that experience like? Yeah. Well, I mean, I love those shows because I don't know much about it, but it's just interesting. I'm always inspired by anyone who has a product of some sort and they believe in it so much that they'll put their whole, you know, savings on the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, their whole livelihood is that. So it's interesting to watch. But what was that experience like? And were there any products that you still think about or, you know, ended up investing in?
So I did the first season. They just finished the second season. So Jeremy Bloom was on that with Tahani Jones. They were just awesome and just two of my closest friends. And so the first season was amazing. You know, it was just a, you know, as you said, you know, we wanted to be the anti-Shark Tank, right? We didn't want to be five people in a room in suits I'm getting presentations.
Yeah, I love it because you're also like competing against each other, you know, like depending on what it is.
I think part of the problem in the first season is that we're all too friendly amongst each other, you know, because we're all such good friends. Mm-hmm. And I think that came across. And the network wanted, you know, us to be, you know,
like
assholes to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, who's Simon Cowell? Who's like, you know, who's this person?
Who's Randy?
Who's Randy, right? But your concept is, you know, is awesome. And, you know, we're in, as you said, we're in the wild, in the deserts mountain, the testing, putting, you know, entrepreneurs through the test. And as you said, you know, the hardest thing with an entrepreneur, and everyone's had no said to them, right? The Google guys have had no said to them. You know, Airbnb, everyone's had no said to them. Not, if not dozens, but, you know, sometimes, you know, 100 times, you know, Walt Disney had no said to him by 165 banks before he got a loan for Disneyland. Everyone's had no sense to them. And it's the hardest thing to say to an entrepreneur, right? Because they come, as you said, with so much passion and they've put so much into this. And like you mentioned, that guy with that shark repellent that we tested in the Bahamas. I mean, that guy put his life savings into that. And it's just like, you know, you don't want to be that guy, but mm-hmm. sometimes you have to be. And I think, you know, part of, you know, my message to a lot of those guys, and girls on the show is that, you know, this is an opportunity for you to take this message and pivot, because there are small inklings of what you're doing, which has an awesome upside, but what you're doing in this instance is just not right. So you try and give a positive message and lead them down a path. There's a huge history of pivoting in Silicon Valley, right? Something's not going right. You got to pivot.
Yeah. Do you watch Silicon Valley on HBO?
I don't. Do because, they talk about that on?
Yes. Oh, okay. The whole show is just pivot, pivot, pivot. Yes.
Okay. That's funny.
Which is how I learned that, basically.
Okay. Yeah. It's like you have to be able to pivot. Mm-hmm. It's not a mission of defeat. Because, you know, running a startup is like, it's just a 24/7 firefight. It's, you know, I tweet all the time about how being an entrepreneur is the hardest job in the world, and everyone who makes a success of it deserves everything they have. And but it's the hardest job in the world, from, you know, the relationships and stress and family and finances and mm-hmm. putting yourself on the line for something you believe and you're passionate about. Because ultimately, as I mentioned before, you want freedom to be able to create your own destiny after that. Because if you have a win, then your whole world kind of changes.
I'm curious, in the, you know, that show is focused on outdoor action sports, that realm. How hard is that a field that's harder to break into versus, say, if you have, you know, you're into in tech or in beauty products, or you know what I mean? How hard is that?
It's a great question, because there are identifiable exits in those sectors that you're talked about, right? So raising funding is easier in those sectors, right? If you go with at the moment, what if you got an AI, artificial intelligence company, or if you've got a Bitcoin company, or if you've got a direct to consumer company, which has, you know, which is kind of being highlighted as the, you know, the next hot things at the moment, right? That's easier than if you're going with, you know, a new mountain bike.
Right.
But the thing about the venture capitalists is that there are a lot of great products on that show, and there's a lot of them that I have in my garage, but there was very few things that I actually wanted to invest in from a business perspective, because venture capitalists are looking for home runs in every deal. They want to see a 10 to 50 to 100 times X, 100X return on those deals, and they're not going into deals thinking, you know, this is kind of cool, I might double my money. That's private equity. Mm. Venture capital wants home runs. Because the fund is only made in terms of the economics by the home runs, because there are so many, you know, there's 70% of the fund that really doesn't return. So the fund only returns to the investors based on those top tier Googles and, you know, Airbnbs and Ubers and those deals. So it's a harder sector to get funding in. It's a harder sector to find deals in. You know, GoPro's kind of an outlier in that, but, you know, GoPro went to $90. It's back, I think, to $5 now, right? So that general sector is becoming more and more fundable, because there's been some good exits in it. And when there are exits in those sectors, more people start paying attention. Mm. It's easier to raise money as a result of that.
Interesting. What were some of the So was there anything that you invested in that season?
We had term sheets on a couple of deals, but none of them eventuated. The first season was kind of, it was kind of a seasonal pilot. You know, we didn't even have a pilot on that show. Literally all the investors, we met in a car park like 10 minutes in before we started shooting in Montecito, up in, you know, Russian Gulch, north of San Francisco. No one knew each other.
Yeah.
Jeremy and Dahani had played against each other in the NFL. I didn't know any of these guys.
Right.
We had no script, no dialogue. It was completely unscripted. We had no idea what to do, talk about, what was going on.
Yeah.
So we were winging it. We were trying to like make out as if we were like investing and the like. And we had, you know, we had honest offers on the table. But, you know, Shark Tank, only 20% of those offers that are made on Shark Tank actually end up being being finalized. Mm. There's a huge showmanship element in that, right? Because, you know, you don't want to go through a whole show without having no offer.
Right.
And then, you know, half of the people that come on Shark Tank don't need funding. They just want to get them free marketing because it's the best marketing ever, right?
Yeah.
Now everyone watches it. You know, and out of the other 50%, you know, various reasons for coming on. But a lot of it now, more and more with Shark Tank, is creating the entertainment factor within it.
Right.
Because Shark Tank, some of the stuff they invest in is just like stupid. Some of the stuff they don't invest in is really good. Like, you know, it's they missed out on Nest.
Nest? Was Nest on Shark Tank?
It's either Nest or Ring, Kelly. It's one of the two. It may have been Ring, which just sold to $1 billion to Amazon.
Wow.
It was Ring, because that's when media made a point of letting Shark Tank know that they didn't invest in them. But like all of these things, venture capitalist was great for me from a brand perspective because it just opened up deal flow coming to me. Which is, you know, as we talked about what venture's all about, you have to be in the middle of the flow and put yourself in that, because if you don't, if you're not seeing the deals, you don't get the opportunity to invest in them.
Hmm.
It's a fun business. It's the best, being a venture capitalist is the, I think, the best job you could have, because every day someone is coming in two or three times with something that hopefully you haven't heard about before.
Yeah.
And showing you something that you say, why the freaking hell didn't I think of that,
yeah.
right?
Oh, totally. And, I bet you have that experience all the time.
That's the best thing about it. And then, you know, no questions off limits, right?
You
ask them whatever you want because they want money.
Right.
So you get a, you know, hour to an hour and a half long education around, you know, it's like having your own private Wikipedia all day, right?
I don't know. I'll tell you what's up and coming.
Exactly.
Canned wine. Yeah.
Okay.
I swear, I see it everywhere. Right. I feel like canned wine is the next something.
Well, you know, Whole Foods is selling it at checkout.
Are they?
Together with little, like, glass bottles of vodka. Like, tiny little, like, 200-mil double-shot bottles of vodka. And I always laugh when I exit Whole Foods because I think that's exactly what you need. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
As you're exiting Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah.
I go, that's there for a reason.
Yeah.
How many people just want to take that?
Yeah.
Just like skull that.
Speaking of Whole Foods and Amazon, they have, I mean, everything that I read, Amazon has a hand in it. Like Twitch, they bought Twitch.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that until this week.
Right.
I don't know if that was recently or what, but I mean, I just feel like, and even related to grocery stores, I have a friend who is a consultant for Deloitte, and she was recently assigned to a project with Kroger.
Excuse me, I've got to write down canned wine here.
Yeah, canned wine.
Canned wine.
Anything esports, probably.
Kelly.
Oh, beauty and tech.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I feel like those two things could probably be hand in hand. Yeah.
Okay.
You're like, all right, enough.
I'm going to go tweet about that and pretend it's mine.
Yeah, I'll give it to you.
Yeah,
But anyways, I have a friend. She was telling me how like certain things that Amazon is doing with grocery stores, like all the other grocery stores now are having to just keep up with that. Like even as far as artificial intelligence with like cashierless grocery stores and all of those things. So the rest of the grocery store industry is like, oh, hello, we got to step up.
There's a lot of disruption that's going to occur in that sector. And there's a lot of super interesting stuff happening now as a result of, you know, just the first steps from the Amazon Whole Foods purchase and what they're doing from a point of sale and that last mile delivery and everything around that. And then you've got this whole ecosystem of, you know, the shared economy with things like, you know, Uber and Lyft and all the subsidiary shared economy services, which are feeding into that first generation of grocery amalgamation from a delivery perspective. You know, Amazon's been for quite some time now using shared ride services at their last mile delivery, right, for their same day service, same day delivery. You know, you get, you know, guys coming to my house now at 10 o'clock at night and I've got 50 packages in the back. They're getting paid like, you know, 70 cents a package to develop. And they're sitting at home, you know, on this shared ride app and just waiting for a call to go pick up 50 packages.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's awesome, isn't it?
I recently met someone who does that. I didn't even know that was a job.
Yeah, right.
And he's bankrolling off of it.
Right, okay.
Because he does it all day long.
Okay.
Maybe I should consider, you know, whatever that's called. So you're done with that. You don't do adventure capitalists anymore, right? Yeah. On to bigger and better things. Yeah. Canned wine.
Exactly.
No one steal that idea.
Don't say it again.
Now, you're also on the, I wrote this down, you're on the advisory board of the Cognitive Health Institute. Uh-huh. Are you still?
Yeah.
Do you know someone, I mean, is there someone in your family who has, because they focus on stem cell therapy specifically for Alzheimer's and other cognitive diseases. Do you know someone, is someone in your family have Alzheimer's?
Yeah, my father-in-law, and he's in sort of the late stage of late onset. So he's now in a home. So we've seen him, you know, deteriorate over the last sort of 8 or 9 years to where he is today. And it's an incredibly destructive, distressing disease for obviously him as well as, you know, the immediate family. And it's, you know, incredibly emotional. And so I wanted to get a seat at that table so I could learn more about that. From my own perspective as well, from the point of my own sort of mental acuity and, you know, cognitive health, even though I don't have any precondition to dementia or Alzheimer's, but as a, you know, 54-year-old male, I wanted to be sort of tuned into what's happening in that sector. And from the point of view of, you know, seeing what the investment opportunities might come from that as well. You know, it's an incredibly destructive disease. And there are so many, you know, people talk about it as being not treatable. And when you start diving into it, it can certainly be halted if you find it early enough. And you can put a sort of like a stop on it for maybe 10 or 15 years. And there are significant, just simple lifestyle approaches that you can take for it through, you know, naturopathic remedies like, you know, I mean, the research around turmeric is just insane in terms of halting
really
progression. And if you go on, you know, the NCBI database of National Health Institute and put in turmeric and Alzheimer's, so it's like hundreds and hundreds of articles that you just look at and going, why isn't this being told? It's just unbelievable. So you can, because it's inflammation based, you have to basically throw yourself into an inflammation, a preventive lifestyle to prevent inflammation.
Yeah.
You know, obviously exercise is key, you know, nutrition and supplements and your lifestyle is a huge driver of it. Stress, sleep is so critical. And we talk about, you know, opportunities in health and wellness. You know, I was at this Consumer Electronics Show this year and half of the health tech floor was about sleep, whether it's through, you know, mattress technologies, cooling technologies, you know, brain stimulation, sleep tech. Sleep's kind of the big thing at the moment. You know,
sleep is
Ariane Huffington's new Thrive Global venture is all around sleep.
Yeah, don't you feel like sleep is one of those things that sometimes people pride themselves on? Oh, I don't need enough sleep.
Yeah.
But then years of that, you know, decades of that, of 6 hours, hours a night,
that's the hardest thing. I mean, we have a really conditioned program that we struggle to keep up with at home and our sort of later 2 hours at night in terms of disconnecting. And I have this thing called the chili pad, which is a cooling pad for my bed, which runs off a little system that sits at the side of the bed. So it runs cooled water through my side of the mattress, not my wife's, because I like it, you know.
It's called a chili pad?
Chili pad, yeah.
Whoa.
So it's it keeps my side of the bed at about 68 degrees, which is optimal for sleeping. So there's a whole environment around sleep that, you know, once you get into it, you see the medical science around it and the health benefits for men from the point of view of testosterone production and human growth hormone and, you know, physical performance, which is all driven by sleep. I mean, it's so, so critical. And it's the most simple thing, right? People, there's this whole biohacking movement, right? You know, bulletproof and all the...
Yeah.
Everyone, you know, it's everyone's trying to hack their system, but there are so many simple things you can do first. You know,
yeah.
It's like, you know, Stephen Covey's seven rocks, right? You know, put in the big rocks first. Don't worry about the sand. You know, that's what you got to focus on. People want the hack. They want the pill. They want the bulletproof coffee. They want the, you know, they want it to happen straight away, right?
Right.
And where there are simple things that you can do from a diet, nutrition, sleep perspective to get you back on track. I mean, if you, go ahead, Kelly.
No, I was just going to say, that's such a good point, because there's so many times, I was just in, speaking of Whole Foods, I was just there yesterday, and when you're in the aisle with, you know, bone broth or MCT oil or all these various things, I'm like, this sounds good for me.
Yeah.
What does it do? I don't know. But really, it just, you have a good diet and you sleep, then that can probably help with mental clarity too.
For sure. And staying healthy is not that hard. Depends on what your outcome is. You want your outcome to be, right? If you want to look jacked and go do CrossFit.
Yeah.
You know, if you
call the performance coach.
Yeah. You know, this depends on what you want your outcome to be. You see all these rabbits running on the treadmills. It's like, what are you trying to do, right? What's your outcome on that? You know, are you trying to get better cardiovascular health? Are you trying to get, you know, your diabetes, type 2 diabetes under control? Or are you just running for running's sake?
Right.
Because there's really no output from that unless you've got an objective around it. But sleep, I sleep more than anything. If, like, in terms of what I'm focusing my own personal wellness around at the moment, it's about sleep, because I struggle with it. I'm getting like 6.5 hours now, which it's pretty good for me. But I need to get 7+, because beyond 7+, you see in the studies, your testosterone increases by 15%. Human growth hormone is activated again. There's a whole bunch of like things that just like start happening.
Wow.
It's a big focus of mine.
Yeah.
And people, as you say, there's a whole, you know, work hard, play hard, you know, no sleep mentality. Nah, it doesn't work, especially when you're my age. Yeah.
And part of that probably is turn off your cell phone, which is such a discipline.
For sure.
Before bed, you know, I mean, I use it as an alarm clock. So then I just end up, oh, I'll turn my alarm on. And then I'm like, I should probably check in, see what's going on over here. You know?
Yeah.
And then it's a whole thing. And then you're just staring at the screen.
You're down the rabbit trap, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim Ferriss has got a pretty good program for the mornings, because, you know, he wakes up and, I mean, I'm pretty much exactly on it, just coincidentally. You know, I do my journal, the 5-minute journal about the things that, you know, I want to achieve today, the things I'm grateful for. And then I, well, actually that follows. I do like a 15-minute meditation. I do my journal and I make my, you know, matcha tea mix, and then, you know, I train, and then I don't open my emails or check my Instagram or anything like that until after that. And Tim Ferriss calls it like letting down the windows of his bulletproof car, right? Because as soon as you got all the things that matter out of the way, then let the bullets in, right? Because if, you know, you go to your phone straight off your bed, you look at it, guaranteed something's happening, right? And I'm operating on 3 different time zones with Australia and East Coast and here, and something's always happened overnight that's ready to greet me. And I just want to put that off. I don't want that to define my immediate moments after I wake up. And I don't want Instagram to define that, because that's not going to help me. You know, I saw this interview with Gene Simmons the other day from Kiss, and he said, you know, he's never smoked weed or done drugs or drunk alcohol. You go, Gene Simmons from Kiss, right? Who believe that? Because he said, when someone gives me a study that says it's going to make me more money, I'll start doing both of them. And, so that's kind of like Instagram, right?
Wow, that's really remarkable. He's
right, Gene Simmons.
He's never ingested alcohol
or taken drugs.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd kind of call BS on that, but
it sounds nice. Right. I believe it. Shoot. So, your new prime I'm assuming that's available anywhere.
Yep.
You have a, for someone, it's specifically focused towards men who are 40 and over. But you have a certain program in there that can, people can follow, and it can help with just more energy, more sexually satisfied, better being happier, all of those things, right? And I assume that you can get that on your website or on Amazon.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. And it's funny, you know, even as early as sort of 2 weeks ago, I was talking to someone about it. He said, you know, it sounds awesome, but, you know, I'm only 39. I'll buy it next year when I'm 40, right? So I'm going to shake that guy. And like,
yeah. My husband's 27. Should I give it to him?
Of course. Yeah. Look, I think, you know, we talked about Tony Robbins and the times that I spent with him. I remember once, you know, I was flying back with him from Palm Springs. We'd been up on a meeting. We were going back to his house, and I was just like, you know, I was kind of overwhelmed that I was actually with Tony Robbins in his jet, right, coming back from, you know, a meeting. It was like,
yeah,
you know, trying to hold it all together and trying to come up with intelligent questions. And so, you know, I asked him, so what, you know, you have these immersive, immense, you know, overwhelming, you know, 3-4 day events, you know, what are people, you know, what's the takeaway that you want people to take away from those? And, you know, what do you consider to be a success? And, you know, for Tony, like my book, I just want someone to take one thing away from it, right? And progressively, which was his answer, which I copy and which I believe in, just take one thing, hopefully more, and then progressively implement that over the years, and which has the potential to drive massive change, whether it's, you know, from diet or exercise or just, you know, getting out of your chair and, you know, in a work environment and standing more. Small steps. And so I've tried to aggregate as many tools that I use personally and that are based on, you know, science and research. Because, you know, I'm always being asked, you know, what makes you the expert? Well, I'm a passionate patient, and like pretty much all cancer patients, they know more than their oncologist, right? And so, you know, I go head to head with, you know, urologists and naturopathic doctors and conventions and speeches with them all the time, because yeah, I feel I know more than they
yeah,
do.
Yeah, I bet you're a very entertaining patient to have.
And I'm not a doctor, but, you know, it's heavily researched and fact-based around the things that matter to men. And for those men who want to make a change to their life, who don't want to be complacent, who want to thrive forward and see that next period of their life as one of opportunities you know, how to break out of, you know, the negative patterns that they're in today. That's kind of the message. And, you know, it's nutrition and, you know, a little bit of fitness, but it's not meant to be that book. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the cover's kind of, you know, 30 Days to Better Sex, Eternal Strength and a Kick-Ass Life. It sounds, you know, like a big ask, but there are tools in there that if you stick to it, that, you will change, that, you know, you'll be a better person after this book. And the great thing for me is that the interaction that I get from men around it and, you know, the inbound communications for it, writing a book is a labor of love, right? You know, cause it's, you don't make money out of it or
right,
anything. It's like, but,
yeah, you're so close to it.
Yeah.
And then you just
made change.
Put it out there.
Yeah. It's gone. It's like, it's not as bad, obviously, as a movie where people tell you it sucks in one day.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the flops.
Yeah.
And I mean, the men's health market is hard. You know, it's not like, you know, you're writing, you know, the women's health market is a lot easier to sell into. And it's not a catch-all for everybody,
mm-hmm,
but I'm really proud of it, of what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, good for you. That's it's incredible. Is your family healthy?
Yeah, they're kind of on my program.
Yeah.
My daughters were with me on the boat last week, and I subsequently got an email from one of the passengers who, and he said, "Your girls are great." Lauren, who's my youngest, made a comment to me one day that, you know, yeah, my parents aren't normal, but they're great, you know, in inverted commas. And Lauren was there at the time. I was like, in this email, I said, what does all that mean? And she said, you aren't like normal. It's like, you're not like my dad's at school. And I said, I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, heck yeah.
Because they've kind of, you know, I think, you know, kids can go two ways, right? They can be dragged up aspirationally by their parents, or they can react and rebel against them. And our kids have done the former. And so, you know, they can't have a conversation with my wife without having, you know, some input about, you know, whether they're drinking out of plastic bottles, or did they take the clean canteen to work that day, or, you know, what are the organic avocados like in Sydney this time of the year? And, you know, we're pretty, we're certainly not, you know, making them in our image, but they've certainly morphed into us.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And all of the, I'm sure a lot of those good things that you've implemented into your own life are going to rub off on them, or already have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, as they get older,
it's the best thing that can happen as a parent, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Do you guys go back to Australia a lot? Or, I mean, are they all in the, are your children, are they adults now? So do they all live in the US?
So we put them back into Australia about 3 and 4 years ago to go to college, and they haven't moved back. They love Sydney too much. I was like, thanks, we're staying. I was like, what? It means I got to come and do something there. So now, as I said, I've invested in the cardiovascular company, and I'm on a bunch of boards and stuff there. So I get back there every like 2 months, which is awesome. Because I kind of, you know, engineered it for me so we could go back there now. Because I didn't go back for 10 years when I first moved here.
Really?
I was too scared to go back because I knew I'd love it too much. And Sydney's just such a beautiful town. So I wanted to not be enticed back when I had so much opportunity here, I think.
Right.
But now I'm back. Excuse me, I'm burping. Now I'm back more and more. And loving it. The kids are just, you know, there's so much opportunity in a town like Sydney. It's kind of like, it's crossed between New York and San Francisco, and great music scene. And, you know, they've got a great, you know, tribe of girls around them who, you know, really hardworking, and, you know, it's just a great community.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist in Orange County.
I was going to say, I don't know much about Orange County. I mean, overall, but I do feel like some of the benefits are it's a little less crowded.
Yeah.
Right. so they grew up in Orange County and went to school there.
Yeah.
And then, okay. And then moved to Australia for college. I mean, I feel like Orange County has probably pros and cons to Sydney, but Orange County is cool. Cause it's, I don't know. I feel like they probably grew up around a lot of hardworking people. In addition to their parents, there's a lot of other.
Yeah. They saw that like there's people are either there, to retire or, you know, according to the FBI, to run away from the law. It's the largest concentration of white collar criminals.
Okay, never mind.
In California. or they're with, you know, Cisco or in the property business. And so they had, we had a lot of, all our friends were entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
But it kind of doesn't rub off on the kids in Orange County.
Gotcha.
So we need to put them into it. Sydney, where people fund themselves through university. Kids work 2 to 3 jobs while they're at school. It's a rite of passage to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's no parent pays for their kids to go to college in Australia. Kids go, why?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, pay it off.
Right.
So they got thrown into that culture, which they just embraced, which was awesome. So suddenly our kids have got 2 and 3 jobs and they want to be cut off from the payroll from us. And it's like, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's incredible. I know. I think about growing up in Ohio, it was more, my experience was more of that, you know, like work and then, you know, buy a car if you want a car.
Yep.
But you have to pay for it and pay for college and whatever.
Yeah.
But then again, I think that experience there, I wasn't necessarily exposed to a lot of different kinds of people, different ways of thinking. Even what you're talking about, like adopting a ketogenic diet, like various things like that are sort of, you know,
over the head.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here I feel like you're kind of more exposed to that, but maybe it's not as
coastal elites, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think the, you know, local coffee shop in, you know, Ohio is serving bulletproof coffee, right?
No. If they are, they're trendy as hell. You know, maybe. I don't know. They could be now. But okay, I'm going to get you out of here. Do you have anything else going on the rest of the day?
I'm just like
a little surfing,
powering through stuff.
Oh, okay.
Got a board call this afternoon.
Gotcha.
Raising money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Raising money.
Yeah. Join the sunshine.
Yes.
So nice.
Is it nice out?
It's beautiful.
I haven't been outside. I work in like a casino. There's right. no windows.
The air quality's better in here.
Yeah. Yeah. The second floor is a little bit better because there's, you know, I can see the outside a bit.
I do.
Yes. But
no, it's just a beautiful California day. I'm just going to go do some work.
Good.
Drive back to Orange County. Hopefully I won't get stuck in the 2 o'clock rush.
Oh, yeah.
On the 10, which is worse than the 405.
If you leave here in the next 10 minutes, you're golden. But if you leave here in 25 minutes, I'm sorry.
I'm not trying to get away from
you, Okay. All right, Mr. Craig Cooper, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you like this episode, share it with a friend, or better yet, leave a written review in your podcast app. Next week, we sit down with a true go-getter and political junkie who's had the experience of interviewing the California candidates for governor, Hillary Clinton, President Trump, and more. So look forward to that. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thank you very much for listening.